supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You know, most of us don't think twice about bringing our work home with us. It seems like it's part of the job anymore these days. The more we put into our work, the better, the better we think it is. But whether we know it or not, all of us inadvertently bring our family issues to the workplace. Whatever role you played in your family, whether it was the good one, the bully, the overachiever, the withdrawn child, the gossip, it's very likely you'll play out that same role at work. So what can be done to make our workplace more about work and leave our families at home, if that's even possible? Later in the hour, we'll be talking about Sylvia LaFair. She's a psychologist, president of Creative Energy Options, and author of Don't Bring It to Work. But first, we'll be talking with psychologist and author Nicole Lipkin about how this issue plays out with Generation Y. She, of Generation X, has written, talks about the Me First generation. Nicole, welcome to the show. What's the title of your book?
Hi, Dan. It's Why in the Workplace, Managing the Me First Generation.
Yeah, there we go. Yes. It slipped my tiny little memory. And our phone number is 888-477-9499. You want to talk about work? You want to gossip or complain or talk about roles different people play in it? Give us a call. 888-477-9499. Later on, we'll find out what companies are doing to make our personal and family issues easier to manage while we're at work without crossing lines or invading privacy. Nicole, what got you interested? You're a Gen Xer.
So I am a Gen Xer.
What got you interested in the younger generation? Why?
Well, a couple of things. My co-author, Dr. April Paramore, and I have both been professors. We both have private practices. We both worked in organizations and have done coaching, working across generations. And I don't know about you, but all we keep on hearing is people pulling their hair out and complaining about this generation, what to do with them, because they seem so different and unique, even though every generation has been.
What's the difference between them and you guys?
Well, a lot of differences. This generation, the parenting and educational system approach really shifted over the past several years. First of all, with parenting, again, the boomers and the older Xers are the parents of Generation Y. We're talking about 8 years old to 28, and this book focuses on 21 to 28. The parenting approach really shifted. Children were very much heard and seen and very much part of family decision-making, which wasn't always the case previously. In education systems, it really shifted, focusing on, hey, let's build self-esteem. Let's focus on self-esteem. It went to such a degree of focusing on self-esteem that it actually became what April and I call the self-inflation movement. Again, all started with good intentions, but when you're giving out gold stars for just showing up or handing in your homework, or gold stars for mediocre performance, that causes a problem.
Yeah, this generation has also been called the second adolescence. A lot of these young people are moving back home, not starting careers, just jumping from job to job. So tell us what they are, why they are what they are?
Well, the boomeranging whys. They're moving back in either because after college they needed to travel the world and have no money, so move back home with mom and dad, financial constraints, or certain expectations of a certain lifestyle, or just wanting to move back home. What this has created, again, is an expectation that, hey, mom and dad are always going to be there. They can fix it. So what happens is, and of course I'm talking generally about this generation, what happens, coupled with this self-inflation movement, when you have these individuals in the workplace, they haven't been taught how to fail. They haven't been taught how to pick up when a mistake's made, which are the foundation, which are the building blocks that help us learn and grow and develop as leaders. So when a minor criticism is given by a boss, like, hey, proofread your document before you put it, hand it in to this to me, a big outburst can occur.
All right, let me argue something with you. I promised you before the show I'd be gentle and
argue away.
Here I am. All that's true mm-hmm. about this generation. And this generation suffer with enormous stress. I've been talking to, well, over the last 10 years, kids in high school, and the stress just increases. They are expected to achieve. They place those expectations on themselves. You know, we just did a series of shows about what boys and girls are living with. They are underslept and overwhelmed. So that's what they carry out also.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Again, opportunities are just enormous for these kids, and expectations are enormous. Getting involved with every extracurricular activity under the sun. The other thing is, it's harder and harder to get into certain colleges, and parents start grooming their kids at a very early age. So the expectation and the pressure that they put on themselves, as well as trying to please others, is pretty enormous. And absolutely, you're seeing lots of one of the chapters in the book is talking about this midlife quarter life crisis and their moods. Very early meltdowns occur just for the slightest type of failure. But again, that is coupled with an inability to fail or the expectation that failure is not going to occur.
Yeah, and we don't see these meltdowns necessarily in school, do we, or do we?
We absolutely do. I mean, we see them in school. I think if you were to look at the statistics, more kids are medicated than ever before. And again, who knows? It's chicken or egg theory here. More kids are medicated. There's more openness to going and seeking mental health help, which is great, more psychological awareness. But we often see the meltdowns occur in the workplace. A lot of times, there's a concept called a helicopter parent, which was coined by Klein and Fay. Really interesting thing that has really blossomed with the parents of this generation.
You even talk in your book about somebody who showed up for a job interview with their parents in tow.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing that didn't go very well.
No, it didn't go very well at all, and this happens all the time. One of the professors we spoke with, a student had handed in a very badly written paper, poor grammar, not following the requirements. The references for the research paper were from Vogue and 17 magazine. The student failed. Anyway, the mother called the professor and started arguing, what are your grading criteria? And arguing, you know, you can't fail my daughter, blah, 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 blah. What happened after that is a loss of respect for the student, an inability to treat the student like a young adult, and an inability to communicate, kind of fear of treating this adult like an adult. And this is what's happening in the workplace. Again, I'm talking generally. You have a very talented group, a very talented generation, and there's lots of positives they bring in. But the problems that they're bringing in, again, are this inability to fail and this constant protection or fallback on mom and dad.
Let's talk about that. You know, we know that these kids are more narcissistic, that I mean, that's what self-esteem really translates to.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that they have less problem-solving skills. So it's obvious that when they get to the workplace, they're less protected, and that's where they're going to have their meltdowns. But,
yes.
I think of Ecclesiastes. You know, there's a time for living and a time for dying. So who succeeds and who fails in these contexts? What kinds of, I hate to say this, kids, what kinds of, you know, this generation succeeds and who fails and what needs to be done?
Well, that is quite a loaded question.
I got time.
Yeah, good.
You know, it's public radio.
We can have this discussion. Well, I think, again, we are talking about the next generation of leaders, which is very important to keep in mind. This generation is 72, it's as close to the baby boomers. Generation X, my generation, is very small. It's Generation Y that really is the next generation of leaders, and they're going to take over the legacies left by the boomers. It's really up to the boomer managers and the older X managers to groom and shape this generation, to help them, to help discover their talents and help lift them up.
I want to argue with you.
Okay, argue.
Again.
Yes, please.
I who promise to be gentle.
Yes.
So if I'm a manager.
Yes.
And I have somebody who's that fragile mm-hmm. working under me, I don't want to groom them. I've got 50 people, especially in this economy. I got 50 people waiting for their job. I want to get somebody who I don't have to groom or I don't have to raise. They should be raised by the time they get to me.
Absolutely. And I agree with that. And again, you know, but we all know from the leadership research, the best leaders are the ones that invest their time in their top talent and help them be better than they ever were as leaders. We know that about with leadership research. So I absolutely agree. And, you know, I'm kind of describing a picture of a big crying baby, and that's not what I'm talking about. Some are. However, this generation brings a lot of talent. Technologically speaking, they were raised on different platforms technologically. Their communication, their ability to communicate, their ability to connect.
I want to pick up on that. Let's get a call in first.
Sure.
and let our listeners start to join us. We're talking about bringing the family to the workplace, whether we like it or not. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. For the first part of our show, we're talking about this Generation Y and what happens when they come to the workplace, what can be done and what should be done, and what we can do for, I guess, Generation Z to make sure it doesn't happen. Generation after that, I guess they just don't have an identity. That's the number is 888-477-9499. Let's go to Sarah. Sarah, hi, you're on Voices.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to share my experience working with, I guess you're calling Generation, what is it, Z?
Why?
Why?
Why? Okay. I am in my early 50s and have had a number of different positions over the years as sort of a mid-manager. With some authority and leadership role. And most recently, I worked very closely with the Obama campaign, in which I was one of very few adults working with this generation. Most of them, 80% of them, were under the age of 30. And I was, it was the most frustrating professional experience I've ever
Wow.
encountered. First of all, I want to agree with that these young adults are very, very smart, sharp, you know, bring a lot of resources to a, you know, an industry agency, whatever have you. But this experience of working with them, and I found it so frustrating in that I could not work with them as sort of as an equal partner, actually. There was no mutual respect for the wisdom and the skills that have, you know, that I've developed over many years working in many different environments in which something that you cannot really learn from school out of a theory-based class. And it was you know, somewhat disrespectful, I felt. It was not an intergenerational experience. It was as if they knew everything and could not, you know, were not willing to learn.
Well,
I mean, it was...
I'd like to... get Nicole's mm-hmm. take on that. And Nicole, we, you know, we're talking about a special group mm-hmm. of kids when they're volunteering for a political campaign. This is a special group who are devoted to something outside of their individual needs. So you'd think they'd have a wider vision. Sarah, thanks so much for your call.
And I completely agree with Sarah, and these are the same stories we're hearing. And it's interesting, not so special of a group. This generation, again, the hippies raised the hipsters. This generation is more socially conscious. They will only work for companies, again, a generalization here, only work for companies that offer volunteerism, that are part of social causes, that help the community, that are environmentally friendly. This is a very powerful generation. But what Sarah brought up was very interesting. That's part of the complaints. This is one of the first generations that the lack of that respect is earned. Just because you're the boss doesn't mean that you know everything.
Let's bring in a Generation Y caller. We've got John on the line. Hey, John.
Hello?
Hi, John. You're on Voices. Thanks for calling.
I was wondering if you think that this problem with Generation Y is because there's not this, like, parents don't raise their children with an expectation that they should have responsibility for themselves and, like, integrity in their actions. Like, there's always, you can always go back and say, hey, that's not my fault, you know. Like, I shouldn't be held responsible for this mistake I've made.
Well, what's your, are you part of this generation?
Yeah, I'm 22. I'm just about to end my collegiate experience. And I'm probably not going directly into the workforce. I mean, I'm graduating with a fine arts degree. So I'm going to do a little travel. But, I mean, in my own experience, I feel like if I make a mistake, it's my responsibility. And I should deal with that, like, professionally. Like, if I'm in that kind of situation where I get, like, criticism or something like that, it's up to me to deal with it like an adult, you know?
You're not seeing that in your peers?
What's that?
You're not seeing that in your peers?
For the most part, no. I mean, people are always just trying to find an excuse or, like, a reason to say, like, give me another chance. Like, this is just, like, a practice, you know?
I want to ask you a question. I want to get Nicole's reaction to that point, but I want to ask you a question before we say goodbye to you.
Mm-hmm.
When you do go into the workplace, what are your expectations about what you're going to find, what you're going to give, and what you're going to get?
Well, I just expect to, you know, work my hardest and try to deliver what is needed of me. And, like, if I mess up, then it's my own deal. And if I do well, then that's also my own work that went into that.
How long do you expect to stay on your first job?
I don't know. I'm going to be farming for, like, 2 months this summer, but I'm not exactly sure, like, what job I'll end up in. But regardless of what job I end up in, I'll try and stay. And, you know, if I don't like it, I guess I'll leave. But if I have time invested in it and, like, it's working out, then I'll stay there.
Good for you. John, I wish you the best. Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You know, John brought up a really good point, really interesting point that we make in this book, is because of the boomeranging effect, moving back home with mom and dad, that this generation has a longer time to grow up. We call it the prolonged adolescence. They have a longer time to figure out what they want to be. And you might talk to a 28-year-old and they're still figuring out what they want to be. Again, their parents, they watched their parents get laid off after 25 loyal years. So this generation is not
right.
Loyal to organizations.
And vice versa, I want to say.
Absolutely. What they are loyal to, and this is very positive about this generation, their relationships, again, being seen and heard in their families, very close relationships and friendships with their parents and friends because of the technological platforms. This generation is very loyal to people. So if and it very much craves mentorship. So if a mentorship relationship is formed with a boss and a good, strong relationship is formed, the loyalty to the boss really is pretty outstanding. And will help that Generation Y person remain in the organization.
So that works out pretty well, because as people age, most people crave mentoring, crave to mentor. It's what we need to do. We need to leave something, you
Absolutely.
Know, with somebody.
It's leaving a legacy.
Yeah, we're going to have to take a break, and we're going to bring on Sylvia LaFaire pretty soon. But we do have one question.
Mm-hmm.
One of the callers called in and said, all of these, and I know you're generalizing, and you've said that too, but all of these issues, this caller said, is true for a certain economic status. You know, you're talking about middle, upper middle class, upper class kids. You're not talking about lower socioeconomic status, and it's a whole different experience, yes?
Sure. It's a whole different experience. And again, our book is geared towards the workplace or corporations, organizations. So absolutely, it is, you know, socioeconomic factors do play in, gender plays in, obviously. So there's obviously differences that we did not address.
One final question before our break. What needs to be done? Does the onus fall on the people at the workplace to do the job the parents didn't do? What needs to be done?
Huge question. Again, we do have some coaching recommendations for organizations. More globally and socially speaking, there needs to be a shift again in the educational system. Again, not rewarding for mediocre performance, holding kids responsible and accountable for their actions, because again, when you fail and when you make mistakes and you learn and grow from them, you develop responsibility and accountability, and that's what generally is lacking and causing some problems in the workplace. The coaching solutions for organizations are a little different. You want me to get into them?
No. Okay. No, we've got to take our break.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This has been great. We've got to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk with Sylvia LaFaire, psychologist, president of Creative Energy Options. And her new book is titled Bring It to Work, which don't bring it to work. Sorry, Sylvia, which examines workplace behaviors, performance, and family systems. We've been talking with Nicole Lipkin, who's also a psychologist, clinical director of Equilibria Psychological and Consultation Services. She's also the co-author of the upcoming book, Why in the Workplace? Managing the Me First Generation. Later on, we'll talk with Maureen Corcoran. She's vice president of diversity at Prudential Financial. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
ChristianaCare supports WHYY and your efforts to stay healthy. ChristianaCare's Helen F. Graham Cancer Center is one of only 14 in the country selected by the National Cancer Institute as a community cancer center program. Patients are offered a team of medical experts backed up by the latest research trials, technology, and a personal care coordinator who guides them every step of the way. More information online at ChristianaCare.org/cancer.
Pop music is rarely taken seriously as literature, but the two have more in common than you think.
That's right, Jim. And this week on Sound Opinions, the world's only rock and roll talk show, you and I are going to discuss pop music's literary influences and name the best lyricists from the page to the stage. Join us for Rock Lit 101.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about families and the workplace, what we bring into the workplace. We bring more than our bodies and our best hopes to do a good job. We bring our families into the workplace. So to hear more about that and what can be done is Sylvia LaFaire. She's a psychologist, president of Creative Energy Options. And her new book is called Don't Bring It to Work, which examines workplace behaviors, performance, and family systems. Sylvia, welcome to the show.
Hi, Dan. Good to hear you.
Yeah, you too. Again, our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Sylvia, I know about your background in family therapy, because we studied family therapy together. I hate to tell you this. It was over 30 years ago.
Well, it seems like yesterday.
Yeah,
so
we were both 11 at the time. But you went, well, not from family therapy, but you were drawn into industry because you saw parallels between the workplace and the family. So you said you saw many similarities and many differences. So let's start with the similarities.
Okay, well, let me just tell you how it started. Was I was doing family therapy, and we had a lot of programs for people and who were, you know, working things out in their lives. And someone asked if I would come work with his senior leadership team. And I said, why? And he said, they're fighting. And I said, so what? And he said, but wait, you work with people who have to get along better, have to learn how to get along better, families, they have to learn how to get along better. So I went in and used the concepts that I had learned from working with families, and lo and behold, people started talking with each other more effectively, and there were changes that were fairly dramatic over a three-month period. And that led into this new direction.
You said you used the techniques from family therapy, like what?
Well, a lot of the techniques were teaching people how to talk and, you know, using I statements rather than you statements,
mm-hmm.
helping people become accountable, really working with more effective listening tools. Then we took people even deeper to begin to look at how they are in the system and the patterns from the family that they were bringing into the workplace.
One of the major differences between workplace and families is that people in the workplace can be fired. It's hard to get fired from your family even when you want to. This environment has the potential to make everybody feel more fragile, and anxiety could make things worse. So I would imagine whatever roles we play in our family in the face of anxiety, especially in this economy, could be exaggerated here.
Well, I think you hit exactly the place that these occurrences of these patterns come heavy duty in the workplace. We are hardwired to survive, and our families are hardwired to keep us surviving. So each of us would take a role in the family for that very thing, to survive. So you would have the super achiever. You were talking with Nicole about a group of super achievers in the family. They're also the rebels who do run away. They're the ones who you could see as being fired. And then they're the martyrs who do everything all the time, and the avoiders who, anytime there's conflict, they gotta go. Everybody has their role. When in the workplace anxiety really kicks in, which is what's happening now in, with our economically induced stress, we all automatically go back to those early behaviors and start playing them out.
I don't want to get too technical here.
Okay.
You talked about those roles that we have in our family, but you said they are about survival. So how is an overachiever or an avoider about survival in the family?
Well, in a family wanting to survive, an avoider will help with the survival by running away, and then everybody has to run after him or her, and they forget about the deeper issues that they're looking at so that we can create sort of a cover. Super achievers are often making up for some kind of shame or discomfort in the family that has happened, and they want to prove that the family genetic material, if you will, is good.
Yeah,
so it's interesting to see how these roles start to take them on.
Well, we also started to notice with Generation X, and even more so in Generation Y, that parents are under a great deal of stress, whether it's self-imposed or externally imposed. And what I see with these kids, these young people, is they do whatever they can to help diminish the stress in the family. So if that's overachieving to diminish parents' anxiety about their achievement, or if it's withdrawal or being the perfect child, or, you know, some just can't take it and act out, and then that distraction helps diminish the stress in the family in many respects. So,
well, you and I are talking the same language. That's exactly what happens. And what happens is those roles get hardwired in the older centers of the brain. We know enough from neuropsychology now to see that these older patterns that are in our brains will kick in, and we begin to take those roles on at work to help and protect each other, interestingly enough.
We're talking with Sylvia LaFair about how we bring family patterns into the workplace. If you see it, or you do it, or you see it with your peers, give us a call. 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. So tell us, get what that looks like in the workplace. Give us an example of what you've seen.
What it looks like in the workplace is, I want you to picture this. Picture the dinner table as you were growing up and having dinner, and then overlay the office meeting table. And what you'll see is in meetings, someone will deflect the information, and somebody else will start to make loud noises about things. This happens when the stress kicks in. And I'll give you an example of a super achiever who really got it. This is a group we had worked with, and they were beginning to look at the patterns, and they were doing best practices, and this one guy kept going on and on and on and on, and people were getting glazed over and thinking about what they were going to have for dinner or, you know, what was on TV that night. And finally somebody said, "What is your intention?" And he looked around, he said, "You know, I've always been a super achiever, and I've wanted to prove how good I am, and I guess I got carried away." And he sat down, it got really quiet. I was facilitating, I did a very smart thing, I called for a break, and then I watched the people going over to acknowledge him for the courage to tell the truth. When we came back, that group moved into a place of such creativity, it was incredible.
Hmm. So the family at work shifted.
At work, exactly.
You said of all the destructive patterns in the workplace, you know, you talk about victim or martyr, you said the most destructive was the splitter. What's a splitter? I mean, that's sounds like a gossip to me, yes?
Well, it's a gossip with fangs. A splitter is somebody who will go to one person and say, "You know, I heard Joe say he really doesn't like the way you do your reports and that they're sloppy and so forth." Getting that guy riled up, who will say, "Who does that Joe think he is? He, you know, he's really stupid." And then he'll run over to Joe and say, "Boy, he really thinks you're stupid." Then the splitter will stand back and watch these two people icily walk past each other. The problem with splitters are they're very clever, and it's very hard to detect because you really think they have your best interests at heart.
Yeah, I'm a little uncomfortable, I have to be honest, with these labels because that's not who people are. You know, you can't say Joe is a splitter because Joe is a person, you know, and this is something he does. Well, why would somebody do that? In the 70s, we used to call it "let's you and him fight." Why would somebody do it? Tell us the underpinnings, the person.
Yeah, well, Dan, I want to say something first. I agree with you. I'm not crazy about labels. But what I realized as I began this work is people need something to hang their hat on initially till they can go deeper. We're very complex, multi-layered creatures, we human beings. This is one way of getting in the door to begin to see behavior.
Hmm.
So I do want to acknowledge that you're right about that.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Amir on the line. Amir, hi, you're on Voices.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thanks.
I just wanted to make a comment that you guys are talking about the function of family in the workplace in a negative way, but I think that it can be taken in a very positive way, whereas when, for example, siblings will compete with each other to do better in the family, so will people in a workforce do the same thing. I find that where I work, we have a boss, a father figure, and all of us sort of compete to do better. And what drives us is not necessarily a will to make the company better, because the company is what it is now, but rather a will to sort of achieve better than each other.
Well, let me suggest something to you, and I think you make a great point. And yeah, psychologists tend to be guilty of looking at the negatives because we don't know how to deal with positives. But I would suggest that this competition you have with this for this father figure is great, depending on your father. If your father was loving and nurturing and you wanted to please him, that's great. But if your father was kind of emotionally, if it was a zero-sum game, so that if you got something and then your sibling did not, if your father if your father was not generous of spirit, kind of emotionally impoverished, then competition feels bad, it feels dangerous and lethal. I mean, it feels like your life is at stake. So, you know, it could go either way, again, depending on what you bring from your family.
Yeah.
Sylvia?
Well, I agree with what Dan just said. The other thing is you're right, Amir. We bring good things with us. We have the good, the bad, the beautiful, and the ugly all mixed together. So we do bring altruism. We bring, you know, kindness with us. What I'm talking about is when anxiety and stress really hit the hot button, we tend to go back to those patterns that, and Dan and I said it earlier, that are there. We want to help the family, but as kids, we didn't know how to do it, so we did it in any way we could. The other side of this is once you see these patterns, the ones that you don't like that aren't working, in Don't Bring It to Work, in my book, I have the way to transform it to get to the healthy opposite, which is what it's really about.
How so?
Well, think one...
Give us the quick and dirty answer.
Okay, the quick and dirty is we have to go back and really look at why we were, what these roles we were playing, and then begin to look at the fact that we have to rewire our nervous systems, really practice languaging, talking with people. We have a process called pep talk, pattern encounter process, where you have to take the pattern and talk about it and then move it to the healthy opposite. One quick one is the super achiever becomes a creative collaborator. They don't have to step on or over people. They begin to work with.
How does this play out at the CEO level? Do the CEO hire people who feel like his or her family? I know my first boss and mentor, a man I loved, he was the youngest of three siblings, having three older sisters, and no matter what he did, he always had three women there taking care of him, an administrative assistant, a secretary, somebody else, always taking care of him. So what happens when the CEO brings family of origin to work?
Well, you know, water does roll downhill, and the CEO, I think Amir said it too about his good boss. There are people who do set up the competition, or they're not available to work things through and they run away. I think that the biggest process right now is self-awareness so that we can begin to see where we fit in the system and then take the parts that work, bring it forward, and work on the parts that we need to change.
Hmm. Well, we've got to take a break now. When we come back, we're going to talk with Maureen Corcoran, who's the Vice President of Diversity at Prudential Financial. And think about that title, Vice President of Diversity. We wouldn't have seen that 20 years ago. It just warms my heart that we have someone with such a title. And we're going to talk about how the workplace should respond to people who have real important pressing needs about their families, not just the internal ones we bring, but the external ones also. Sylvia, thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck with your book.
Thanks, Dan.
Sylvia LaFaire is a psychologist and president of Creative Energy Options, which is a leadership consulting company. Her book is called Don't Bring It to Work. It examines workplace behavior, performance, and family systems. Like I said, we'll be back in just 60 seconds, and we'll be talking with Maureen Corcoran, Vice President of Diversity at Prudential Financial. Our number is 888-477-9499. We'd like you to call about your industry and what they do for your special needs. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
The University of Pennsylvania supports WHYY and is conducting a research study of bone strength. Women who are at least 60 years old who have had a bone fracture or have been told they need treatment for osteoporosis may qualify for this study. Women who qualify will receive osteoporosis medication for 2 years and reimbursement for travel. More information about the osteoporosis study is available at 215-898-5664.
Hey, Philadelphia, NPR's Midday News Talk program Tell Me More already has its eye on the 215. Over the past year, we've heard everybody from Mayor Michael Nutter on how he's dealing with the budget crisis.
Unlike the federal government, I can't deficit spend, and we don't print money in the basement.
To the Roots' Questlove on becoming a band on late-night TV.
We kind of have a history of being on our own island.
I'm Michelle Martin. Expect to hear more conversations that go beyond the headlines on Tell Me More this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. As promised, we're talking with Maureen Corcoran. She's Vice President of Diversity at Prudential Financial. Maureen, thanks so much for joining us. Do we have you?
Yes.
Oh, thank you for joining us. So you're Vice President of Diversity at Prudential Financial. How long has Prudential had a Vice President of Diversity?
Prudential began its diversity efforts in 1990, formally in 1990. Prior to that, of course, it was involved in equal opportunity and affirmative action. But it formalized the integration and valuing of diversity into all of our processes, beginning in 1990 with a mandatory training program for Prudential's executives and managers, and then from there, a series of programs and initiatives developed, and we've been going strong ever since then.
I've got a question you might not be able to answer. I know you obviously you're a Prudential person and know a lot about that, but could you talk about industry in general? How many people do have someone in your title? Is that with your title, and is that unusual in industry, or is it pretty common these days?
I think it's pretty common, whether they have that exact title or they're in an office and a group of individuals that deals with the integration of diversity into their workplace and even into their marketing and, of course, outreach to customers and clients in our various markets. I think that from a importance of the issue end, many companies have realized the value of looking at this and addressing it. I think the larger organizations are more likely to have an office devoted to this initiative, and you're likely to see those titles there, but it's really an issue that is addressed by nonprofits now, for-profit organizations, government organizations. In fact, there are a number of roundtables and groups that companies can associate themselves with for benchmarking, to talk with other leaders at those organizations about these issues, gain knowledge about best and promising practices, so that we can steal shamelessly and implement productive programs.
And I want to talk about that. First of all, I want to talk about labels. I mean, we talked about your label of Vice President of Diversity. I want to talk about this special needs label and how it gets defined. You know, we've been hearing the Supreme Court, perhaps over the last 5-8 years, defining special needs more and more narrowly. How about you? How about Prudential?
I think the concern of Prudential and a lot of other corporations who look at this issue is really what is needed by our employee population the most. And that can be very specific around issues, for example, that are neurological, around autism if they're caring for individuals, children or adults. It can also be very general. Individuals that just need a little direction or support in finding resources in their communities maybe less specific issues of disability. And not all employees are comfortable talking about exactly what they are. So at Prudential, we create programs and services that are broad-based.
What does that look like? I'm trying to tell us what these programs look like, how they behave.
Well, it starts with trying to create a sort of a culture of support at the firm. So from the chairman first down through management, we express our commitment to supporting employees in their concerns from their life outside of work and enabling them to get the resources they need to continue to focus on their job and address the needs of their families. And that conversation, that language is repeated over and over again, in fact, almost weekly, in communications to employees through highlighting the programs that are being offered. So some of those programs would include 800 number, 24/7 resource and referral. They can call one of our vendors that we've contracted with to identify programs and services within their own communities. They can talk to a counselor as well as go on a website and do that at the same time. And the counselor online, completely confidential, can direct them to their specific needs.
Let's talk about what's in the program in Prudential. How do you help, say, someone who's caring for a parent with Alzheimer's or a single parent with a child with autism? Is what kind of accommodations are made there, and what's reasonable for someone to ask for or expect?
Well, there are a number of things that individuals can access and sort of cobble together a solution that fits their needs. So, for example, they can access, as I said, that resource and referral and find specific help in their community. They can ask for flexible work arrangements from the firm to enable them to manage their schedule around their caregiving needs. Dependent, and they ask that of their managers, and dependent upon the job that they have. And, of course, their performance does matter to some degree. They have to be able to, if they want to telecommute, for example, indicate that they can work independently. But they can put together a schedule that enables them to have this life outside of work, as well as perform their job duties and achieve their business objectives.
Hmm.
Additionally, we offer special forums. We've offered a forum for parenting on children with special needs and adults. We had panels of experts around, for example, estate planning, how to plan for taking care of your children financially as they, after you're gone, and preparing for their future if they have special needs. We've taken resources from those forums and posted them on the company's Work Life Resources website, which is available to all of our employees domestically. They can access that without having to go to a human being, go through those resources, and then there are contacts associated with those. They can call us. There's a team here that addresses their needs when they call for specific help.
Speaking of human beings, in this economy, for someone who has special needs, the stress really increases. And I've read where a substantial number of these parents or children caring for a parent with Alzheimer's have been fired in the past because of their special needs, because of lack of accommodation. So I would guess that some of the people with the greatest needs are hesitant to come forward. Is there any way you can help them? I know managers can't pry, but they are supposed to care.
Well, what we try and do is create an environment where it's safe to stay, we call it, so that employees feel comfortable that the company is interested in helping them to manage their life issues. Of course, we're also very interested in getting the job done, and so these programs and services are self-serving to some degree. Take advantage, we tell employees, of what we're offering you. You can do it confidentially. You can speak with your manager. We make sure managers have the resources to be able to point employees towards the various programs and services we offer. Managers aren't going to say that they're experts on these subjects, but they do know who to call and where to go. We also have employee assistance programming so that employees and their household members can have free sessions of counseling and coaching to manage the stresses associated with issues around special needs, caring for an aging loved one who perhaps is in a stage of Alzheimer's.
Let's see if we can get a caller in. We've got Suzanne on the line. Suzanne, hi. You're on Voices.
Hi, Dan. Nice to talk to you again. I haven't spoken with you in a long time.
Oh, thank you.
As a person with a disability, I'm really glad that you're discussing diversity today. And I would like you to comment, if I may, on issues regarding diversity and just the diverse workforce. There are many of us with disabilities who are out here in the workforce working, and on the one hand, we have special needs, but on the other hand, we just want to get the job done just like everyone else. And another thing...
Suzanne, I don't think we're going to have time for another thing. We're down to our last couple of minutes. I'm going to ask Maureen to respond to, relationships with people with disabilities in the workplace.
Yeah, Suzanne, that's an excellent question. We are equally focused on supporting our employees in the workforce who may have disabilities themselves as well as are caring for those and who have disabilities. And we have an internal group that's quite popular. It is open to all employees. It's called ADAPT, Abled and Disabled Associates Partnering Together. Their role is to provide support for each other, educate our workforce, which they do regularly, about the issues of disabilities in the workplace, educate management on being sensitive, and supporting individuals whom they work with, and integrating those same learnings into our ability to deal productively and respectfully with the marketplace around these issues.
Go on.
So what that does is it creates a lot of conversation internally. It makes the issue brings the issue to a point of discussion, so people aren't sort of whispering and wondering what to say and how to say it, what to do and how to do it. We also have quite an extensive and well-publicized resource website around accommodations so that management knows what's available to help employees to be as productive as possible. And then all of our diversity initiatives are really focused on making sure that we have an inclusive place to work, that no one feels isolated or separated out, and that with regularity, we are interacting with a variety of individuals.
Maureen, let me ask you, could you envision, and we've only got about 30 seconds left, a day when a company doesn't need a vice president of diversity?
I think that that isn't unrealistic to think that that would happen. However, as you've mentioned a number of times, and the organization I'm a part of is called Human Resources, as long as we're hiring humans, we will need to be introduced and reintroduced to our own issues around diversity.
That's a great point. I want to thank you so much for joining us, Maureen. Maureen Cochran is Vice President of Diversity at Prudential Financial. Early on, we heard from Sylvia LaFaire, who is a psychologist and written a book called Don't Bring It to Work, which examines workplace behaviors, performance, and family systems. Earlier on, we heard from psychologist Nicole Lipkin. She's clinical director of Equilibria Psychological Consultation Services. She's the co-author of the upcoming book, Why in the Workplace? Managing the Me First Generation. It'll be out in July. Next week, we'll be talking about research and legislation about autism. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is the executive producer of radio content. Executive producers Mike and Scott. Our producer is Gita Simons. Elisa Walters is our associate producer. Our intern's Jonathan Glick. And I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host.